Everything I've said about dialogue applies to building characters in fiction. The job boils down to two things: paying attention to how the real people around you behave, and then telling the truth about what you see. You may notice that your next-door neighbor picks his nose when he thinks no one is looking. This is a great detail, but noting it does you no good as a writer unless you're willing to dump it into a story at some point. Are fictional characters drawn directly from life? Obviously not, at least on a one-to-one basis. You'd better not, unless you want to get sued or shot on your way to the mailbox some fine morning. In many cases, such as Romana Clef novels like Valley of the Dolls, characters are drawn mostly from life. But after readers get done playing the inevitable guessing game about who's who, these stories tend to be unsatisfying, stuffed with shadowbox celebrities who bonk each other and then fade quickly from the reader's mind. I read Valley of the Dolls shortly after it came out. I was a cook's boy at a Western Maine resort that summer, gobbling it up as eagerly as everyone else who bought it, I suppose, but I can't remember much of what it was about. On the whole, I think I prefer the weekly codswallop served up by the National Enquirer, where I can get recipes and cheesecake photographs, as well as scandal. For me, what happens to characters as a story progresses depends solely on what I discover about them as I go along, how they grow, in other words. Sometimes they grow a little. If they grow a lot, they begin to influence the course of the story instead of the other way around. I almost always start with something that's situational. I don't say that's right, only that it's the way that I've always worked. If a story ends up that same way, however, I count it something of a failure, no matter how interesting it may be to me or to others. I think the best stories always end up being about people rather than the event, which is to say character-driven. Once you get beyond the short story, though, 2 to 4,000 words, let's say, I'm not much of a believer in the so-called character study. I think that, in the end, the story should always be the boss. Hey, if you want a character study, buy a biography or get season tickets to your local college's theater lab productions. You'll get all the character you can stand. It's also important to remember that no one is the bad guy, or the best friend, or the whore with a heart of gold in real life. In real life, we each of us regard ourselves as the main character, the protagonist, the big cheese. The camera is on us, baby. If you can bring this attitude into your fiction, you may not find it easier to create brilliant characters, but it will be harder for you to create the sort of one-dimensional dopes that populate so much pop fiction. Annie Wilkes, the nurse who holds Paul Sheldon prisoner in Misery, may seem psychopathic to us, but it's important to remember that she seems perfectly sane and reasonable to herself. Heroic, in fact, a beleaguered woman trying to survive in a hostile world filled with cock-a-doodle brats. We see her go through dangerous mood swings, but I never tried to come right out and say, "Annie was depressed and possibly suicidal that day." Or, "Annie seemed particularly happy that day." If I have to tell you, I lose. If, on the other hand, I can show you a silent, dirty-haired woman who compulsively gobbles cake and candy, then have you draw the conclusion that Annie is in the depressive part of a manic-depressive cycle, I win. And if I am able, even briefly, to give you a Wilkes-eye view of the world, if I can make you understand her madness, then perhaps I can make her someone you sympathize with or even identify with. The result? She's more frightening than ever because she's close to real. If, on the other hand, I turn her into a cackling old crone, she's just another pop-up bogey lady. In that case, I lose big time, and so does the reader. Who would want to visit with such a stale shrew? That version of Annie was old when The Wizard of Oz was in its first run. It would be fair enough to ask, I suppose, if Paul Sheldon in Misery is me. Certainly parts of him are, but I think you will find that if you continue to write fiction, every character you create is partly you. When you ask yourself what a certain character will do given a certain set of circumstances, you're making the decision based on what you yourself would, or in the case of a bad guy, wouldn't, do. Added to these versions of yourself are the character traits, both lovely and unlovely, which you observe in others. A guy who picks his nose when he thinks no one is looking, for instance. There is also a wonderful third element, pure blue sky imagination. This is the part which allowed me to be a psychotic nurse for a little while when I was writing Misery. And being Annie was not, by and large, hard at all. In fact, it was sort of fun. I think being Paul was harder. He was sane, I'm sane, no 4 days at Disneyland there. My novel, The Dead Zone, arose from two questions. Can a political assassin ever be right? And if he is, could you make him the protagonist of a novel, the good guy? These ideas called for a dangerously unstable politician, it seemed to me, a fellow who could climb the political ladder by showing the world a jolly, just folks face and charming the voters by refusing to play the game in the usual way. Greg Stilson's campaign tactics, as I imagined them 20 years ago, were very similar to the ones Jesse Ventura used in his successful campaign for the governor's seat in Minnesota. Thank goodness Ventura doesn't seem like Stilson in any other ways. The Dead Zone's protagonist, Johnny Smith, is also an everyday, just folks sort of guy. Only with Johnny, it's no act. The one thing that sets him apart is a limited ability to see the future, gained as the result of a childhood accident. When Johnny shakes Greg Stilson's hand at a political rally, he has a vision of Stilson becoming the President of the United States and subsequently starting World War III. Johnny comes to the conclusion that the only way he can keep this from happening, the only way he can save the world, in other words, is by putting a bullet in Stilson's head. Johnny is different from other violent, paranoid mystics in only one way. He really can see the future. Only, don't they all say that? The situation had an edgy, outlaw feel to it that appealed to me. I thought the story would work if I could make Johnny a genuinely decent guy without turning him into a plaster saint. Same thing with Stilson, only backwards. I wanted him to be authentically nasty and really scare the reader, not just because Stilson is always boiling with potential violence, but because he is so goddamn persuasive. I wanted the reader to constantly be thinking, this guy is out of control. How come somebody can't see through him? The fact that Johnny does see through him would, I thought, put the reader even more firmly in Johnny's corner. When we first meet the potential assassin, he's taking his girl to the county fair, riding the rides and playing the games. What could be more normal or likable? The fact that he's on the verge of proposing to Sarah makes us like him even more. Later, when Sarah suggests they cap a perfect date by sleeping together for the first time, Johnny tells her he wants to wait until they're married. I felt I was walking a fine line on that one. I wanted readers to see Johnny as sincere and sincerely in love, a straight shooter but not a tight-assed prude. I was able to cut his principal behavior a bit by giving him a childish sense of humor. He greets Sarah wearing a glow-in-the-dark Halloween mask. The mask hopefully works in a symbolic way, too. Certainly Johnny is perceived as a monster when he points a gun at candidate Stilson. Same old Johnny, Sarah says, laughing, and by the time the two of them are headed back from the fair in Johnny's old Volkswagen Bug, I think Johnny Smith has become our friend, just an average American guy who's hoping to live happily ever after. The sort of guy who'd return your wallet with the money still in it if he found it on the street, or stop and help you change your flat tire if he came upon you broke down by the side of the road. Ever since John F. Kennedy was shot in Dallas, the great American bogeyman has been the guy with the rifle in a high place. I wanted to make this guy into the reader's friend. Johnny was hard. Taking an average guy and making him vivid and interesting always is. Greg Stilson, like most villains, was easier and a lot more fun. I wanted to nail his dangerous, divided character in the first scene of the book. Here, several years before he runs for the U.S. House of Representatives in New Hampshire, Stilson is a young traveling salesman hawking Bibles to Midwest country folk. When he stops at one farm, he is menaced by a snarling dog. Stilson remains friendly and smiling, Mr. Jess Folks, until he's positive no one's home at the farm. Then he sprays tear gas in the dog's eyes and kicks it to death. If one is to measure success by reader response, the opening scene of The Dead Zone, my first number one hardcover bestseller, was one of my most successful ever. Certainly it struck a raw nerve. I was deluged with letters, most of them protesting my outrageous cruelty to animals. I wrote back to these folks, pointing out the usual things. A, Greg Stilson wasn't real. B, the dog wasn't real. C, I myself had never in my life put the boot to one of my pets or anyone else's. I also pointed out what might have been a little less obvious. It was important to establish right up front that Gregory Amos Stilson was an extremely dangerous man and very good at camouflage. I continued to build the characters of Johnny and Greg in alternating scenes until the confrontation at the end of the book, when things resolved themselves in what I hoped would be an unexpected way. The characters of my protagonist and antagonist were determined by the story I had to tell, by the fossil, the found object, in other words. My job, and yours if you decide this is a viable approach to storytelling, is to make sure these fictional folks behave in ways that will both help the story and seem reasonable to us, given what we know about them and what we know about real life, of course. Sometimes villains feel self-doubt, as Greg Stilson does. Sometimes they feel pity, as Annie Wilkes does. And sometimes the good guy tries to turn away from doing the right thing, as Johnny Smith does, as Jesus Christ himself did, if you think about that prayer, "Take this cup from my lips," in the Garden of Gethsemane. And if you do your job, your characters will come to life and start doing stuff on their own. I know that sounds a little creepy if you haven't actually experienced it, but it's terrific fun when it happens, and it will solve a lot of your problems, believe me. We've covered some basic aspects of good storytelling, all of which return to the same core ideas, that practice is invaluable and should feel good, really, not like practice at all, and that honesty is indispensable. Skills in description, dialogue, and character development all boil down to seeing or hearing clearly and then transcribing what you see or hear with equal clarity and without using a lot of tiresome, unnecessary adverbs. There are lots of bells and whistles, too. Onomatopoeia, incremental repetition, stream of consciousness, interior dialogue, changes of verbal tense. It has become quite fashionable to tell stories, especially shorter ones in the present tense. The sticky question of backstory, how do you get it in and how much of it belongs? Theme, pacing, we'll touch on these last two, and a dozen other topics, all of which are covered, sometimes at exhausting length, in writing courses and standard writing texts. My take on all these things is pretty simple. It's all on the table, every bit of it, and you should use anything that improves the quality of your writing and doesn't get in the way of your story. If you like an alliterative phrase, the knights of nowhere battling the nabobs of nullity, by all means, throw it in and see how it looks on paper. If it seems to work, it can stay. If it doesn't, and to me this one sounds pretty bad, like Spiro Agnew crossed with Robert Jordan, well, that delete key is on your machine for a good reason. There is absolutely no need to be hidebound and conservative in your work, just as you are under no obligation to write experimental, nonlinear prose because the Village Voice or the New York Review of Books says the novel is dead. Both the traditional and the modern are available to you. Shit, write upside down if you want to, or do it in Crayola pictographs. But no matter how you do it, there comes a point when you must judge what you've written and how well you wrote it. I don't believe a story or a novel should be allowed outside the door of your study or writing room unless you feel confident that it's reasonably reader-friendly. You can't please all the readers all of the time. You can't please even some of the readers all of the time. But you really ought to try to please at least some of the readers some of the time. I think William Shakespeare said that. And now that I've waved that caution flag, duly satisfying all OSHA, Mensa, NASA, and Writers Guild guidelines, let me reiterate that it's all on the table, all up for grabs. Isn't that an intoxicating thought? I think it is. Try any goddamn thing you like, no matter how boringly normal or outrageous. If it works, fine. If it doesn't, toss it. Toss it even if you love it. Hemingway once said, "You must kill your darlings." And he was right. I most often see chances to add the grace notes and ornamental touches after my basic storytelling job is done. Once in a while, it comes earlier. Not long after I began The Green Mile and realized my main character was an innocent man likely to be executed for the crime of another, I decided to give him the initials J.C. after the most famous innocent man of all time. I first saw this done in Light in August, still my favorite Faulkner novel, where the sacrificial lamb is named Joe Christmas. Thus, death row inmate John Bowes became John Coffey. I wasn't sure, right up to the end of the book, if my J.C. would live or die. I wanted him to live because I liked and pitied him, but I figured those initials couldn't hurt, one way or the other. Mostly, I don't see stuff like that until the story's done. Once it is, I'm able to kick back, read over what I've written, and look for underlying patterns. If I see some, and I almost always do, I can work at bringing them out in a second, more fully realized draft of the story. Two examples of the sort of work second drafts were made for are symbolism and theme. If in school you ever studied the symbolism of the color white in Moby Dick, or Hawthorne's symbolic use of the forest in such stories as Young Goodman Brown, and came away from those classes feeling like a stupidnik, you may even now be backing off with your hands raised protectively in front of you, shaking your head and saying, "Gee, no, thanks, I gave it the office." But wait. Symbolism doesn't have to be difficult and relentlessly brainy, nor does it have to be consciously crafted as a kind of ornamental Turkish rug upon which the furniture of the story stands. If you can go along with the concept of the story as a pre-existing thing, a fossil in the ground, then symbolism must also be pre-existing, right? Just another bone or set of them in your new discovery. That's if it's there. If it isn't, so what? You still got the story itself, don't you? If it is there, and if you notice it, I think you should bring it out as well as you can, polishing it until it shines, and then cutting it the way a jeweler would cut a precious or semi-precious stone. Carrie, as I've already noted, is a short novel about a picked-on girl who discovers a telekinetic ability within herself. She can move objects by thinking about them. To atone for a vicious shower room prank in which she has participated, Carrie's classmate, Susan Snell, persuades her boyfriend to invite Carrie to the senior prom. They are elected king and queen. During the celebration, another of Carrie's classmates, the unpleasant Christine Hargensen, pulls a second prank on Carrie, this one deadly. Carrie takes her revenge by using her telekinetic power to kill most of her classmates and her atrocious mother before dying herself. That's the whole deal, really. It's as simple as a fairy tale. There was no need to mess it up with bells and whistles, although I did add a number of epistolary interludes, passages from fictional books, a diary entry, letters, teletype bulletins, between narrative segments. This was partly to inject a greater sense of realism. I was thinking of Orson Welles' radio adaptation of War of the Worlds, but mostly because the first draft of the book was so damned short it barely seemed like a novel. When I read Carrie over prior to starting the second draft, I noticed there was blood at all three crucial points of the story, beginning, Carrie's paranormal ability is apparently brought on by her first menstrual period, climax, the prank which sets Carrie off at the prom involves a bucket of pig's blood for a pig, Chris Hargensen tells her boyfriend, and end. Sue Snell, the girl who tries to help Carrie, discovers she is not pregnant, as she had half hoped and half feared, when she gets her own period. There's plenty of blood in most horror stories, of course. It is our stock in trade, you might say. Still, the blood in Carrie seemed more than just splatter to me. It seemed to mean something. That meaning wasn't consciously created, however. While writing Carrie, I never once stopped to think, ah, all this blood symbolism will win me brownie points with the critics. Or, boy, oh boy, this should certainly get me in a college bookstore or two. For one thing, a writer would have to be a lot crazier than I am to think of Carrie as anyone's intellectual treat. Intellectual treat or not, the significance of all that blood was hard to miss once I started reading over my beer and tea-splattered first draft manuscript. So I started to play with the idea, image, and emotional connotations of blood, trying to think of as many associations as I could. There were lots, most of them pretty heavy. Blood is strongly linked to the idea of sacrifice. For young women, it's associated with reaching physical maturity and the ability to bear children. In the Christian religion, plenty of others as well, it's symbolic of both sin and salvation. Finally, it is associated with the handing down of family traits and talents. We are said to look like this or behave like that because it's in our blood. We know this isn't very scientific, that those things are really in our genes and DNA patterns, but we use the one to summarize the other. It is that ability to summarize and encapsulate that makes symbolism so interesting, useful, and, when used well, arresting. You could argue that it's really just another kind of figurative language. Does that make it necessary to the success of your story or novel? Indeed not, and it can actually hurt, especially if you get carried away. Symbolism exists to adorn and enrich, not to create a sense of artificial profundity. None of the bells and whistles are about story, all right? Only story is about story. Are you tired of hearing that yet? I hope not, because I'm not even close to getting tired of saying it. Symbolism, and the other adornments too, does serve a useful purpose, though. It's more than just chrome on the grill. It can serve as a focusing device for both you and your reader, helping to create a more unified and pleasing work. I think that when you read your manuscript over and when you talk it over, you'll see if symbolism or the potential for it exists. If it doesn't, leave well enough alone. If it does, however, if it's clearly a part of the fossil you're working to unearth, go for it. Enhance it. You're a monkey if you don't. The same things are true of theme. Writing in literature classes can be annoyingly preoccupied by and pretentious about theme, approaching it as the most sacred of sacred cows, but don't be shocked. It's really no big deal. If you write a novel, spend weeks and then months catching it word by word, you owe it both to the book and to yourself to lean back or take a long walk when you've finished and ask yourself why you bothered, why you spent all that time, why it seemed so important. In other words, what's it all about, Alfie? When you write a book, you spend day after day scanning and identifying the trees. When you're done, you have to step back and look at the forest. Not every book has to be loaded with symbolism, irony, or musical language. They call it prose for a reason, you know. But it seems to me that every book, at least everyone worth reading, is about something. Your job during or just after the first draft is to decide what something or somethings yours is about. Your job in the second draft, one of them anyway, is to make that something even more clear. This may necessitate some big changes and revisions. The benefits to you and your reader will be clearer focus and a more unified story. It hardly ever fails. The book that took me the longest to write was The Stand. This is also the one my longtime readers still seem to like the best. There's something a little depressing about such a united opinion that you did your best work 20 years ago, but we won't go into that just now, thanks. I finished the first draft about 16 months after I started it. The Stand took an especially long time because it nearly died going into the third turn and heading for home. I'd wanted to write a sprawling, multi-character sort of novel, a fantasy epic if I could manage it, and to that end I employed a shifting perspective narrative, adding a major character in each chapter of the long first section. Thus, Chapter 1 concerned itself with Stuart Redman, a blue-collar factory worker from Texas. Chapter 2 first concerned itself with Fran Goldsmith, a pregnant college girl from Maine, and then returned to Stu. Chapter 3 began with Larry Underwood, a rock and roll singer in New York, before going back first to Fran, then to Stu Redman again. My plan was to link all these characters, the good, the bad, and the ugly, in two places, Boulder and Las Vegas. I thought they'd probably end up going to war against one another. The first half of the book also told the story of a man-made virus which sweeps America and the world, wiping out 99% of the human race and utterly destroying our technology-based culture. I was writing this story near the end of the so-called energy crisis in the 1970s, and I had an absolutely marvelous time envisioning a world that went smash during the course of one horrified, infected summer. Really not much more than a month. The view was panoramic, detailed, nationwide, and, to me at least, breathtaking. Rarely have I seen so clearly with the eye of my imagination, from the traffic jam plugging the dead tube of New York's Lincoln Tunnel to the sinister Nazi-ish rebirth of Las Vegas under the watchful and often amused red eye of Randall Flagg. All this sounds terrible, is terrible, but to me, the vision was also strangely optimistic. No more energy crisis, for one thing. No more famine. No more massacres in Uganda. No more acid rain or hole in the ozone layer. Finito as well to saber-rattling nuclear superpowers, and certainly no more overpopulation. Instead, there was a chance for humanity's remaining shred to start over again in a God-centered world to which miracles, magic, and prophecy had returned. I liked my story. I liked my characters. And still, there came a point when I couldn't write any longer because I didn't know what to write. Like Pilgrim in John Bunyan's epic, I had come to a place where the straight way was lost. I wasn't the first writer to discover this awful place, and I'm a long way from being the last. This is the land of writer's block. If I'd had 200 or even 300 pages of single-space manuscript instead of more than 500, I think I would have abandoned the stand and gone on to something else. God knows I had done it before. But 500 pages was too great an investment, both in time and in creative energy. I found it impossible to let go. Also, there was this little voice whispering to me that the book was really good, and if I didn't finish, I would regret it forever. So instead of moving on to another project, I started taking long walks, a habit which would, two decades later, get me in a lot of trouble. I took a book or magazine on these walks, but rarely opened it, no matter how bored I felt, looking at the same old trees and the same old chattering, ill-natured jays and squirrels. Boredom can be a very good thing for someone in a creative jam. I spent those walks being bored and thinking about my gigantic boondoggle of a manuscript. For weeks, I got exactly nowhere in my thinking. It all just seemed too hard, too fucking complex. I had run out too many plot lines, and they were in danger of becoming snarled. I circled the problem again and again, beat my fists on it, knocked my head against it. And then, one day when I was thinking of nothing much at all, the answer came to me. It arrived whole and complete, gift-wrapped, you could say, in a single bright flash. I ran home and jotted it down on paper, the only time I've done such a thing, because I was terrified of forgetting. What I saw was that the America in which the stand took place might have been depopulated by the plague, but the world of my story had become dangerously overcrowded, a veritable Calcutta. The solution to where I was stuck, I saw, could be pretty much the same as the situation that got me going, an explosion instead of a plague, but still one quick hard slash of the Gordian knot. I would send the survivors west from Boulder to Las Vegas on a redemptive quest. They would go at once, with no supplies and no plan, like biblical characters seeking a vision or to know the will of God. In Vegas, they would meet Randall Flagg, and good guys and bad guys alike would be forced to make their stand. At one moment, I had none of this. At the next, I had all of it. If there is any one thing I love about writing more than the rest, it's that sudden flash of insight when you see how everything connects. I have heard it called thinking above the curve, and it's that. I've heard it called the overlogic, and it's that too. Whatever you call it, I wrote my page or two of notes in a frenzy of excitement and spent the next 2 or 3 days turning my solution over in my mind, looking for flaws and holes. Also, working out the actual narrative flow, which involved 2 supporting characters placing a bomb in a major character's closet. But that was mostly out of a sense of this is too good to be true unbelief. Too good or not, I knew it was true at the moment of revelation. That bomb in Nick Andros's closet was going to solve all my narrative problems. It did, too. The rest of the book ran itself off in 9 weeks. Later, when my first draft of The Stand was done, I was able to get a better fix on what had stopped me so completely in mid-course. It was a lot easier to think without that voice in the middle of my head constantly yammering, "I'm losing my book! Ah, shit! 500 pages and I'm losing my book! Condition red! Condition red!" I was also able to analyze what got me going again and appreciate the irony of it. I saved my book by blowing approximately half of its major characters to smithereens. There actually ended up being 2 explosions, the one in Boulder balanced by a similar act of sabotage in Las Vegas. The real source of my malaise, I decided, had been that in the wake of the plague, my Boulder characters, the good guys, were starting up the same old technological death trip. The first hesitant CB broadcasts beckoning people to Boulder would soon lead to TV. Infomercials and 900 numbers would be back in no time. Same deal with the power plants. It certainly didn't take my Boulder folks long to decide that seeking the will of the God who spared them was a lot less important than getting the refrigerators and air conditioners up and running again. In Vegas, Randall Flagg and his friends were learning how to fly jets and bombers, as well as getting the lights back on, but that was okay, to be expected, because they were the bad guys. What had stopped me was realizing, on some level of my mind, that the good guys and bad guys were starting to look perilously alike. And what got me going again was realizing the good guys were worshiping an electronic golden calf and needed a wake-up call, a bomb in the closet, would do just fine. All this suggested to me that violence as a solution is woven through human nature like a damning red thread. That became the theme of The Stand, and I wrote the second draft with it fixed firmly in my mind. Again and again, characters, the bad ones like Lloyd Henreid, as well as the good ones like Stu Redman and Larry Underwood, mention the fact that all that stuff, that is, weapons of mass destruction, is just lying around waiting to be picked up. When the Boulderites propose, innocently, meaning only the best, to rebuild the same old neon Tower of Babel, they are wiped out by more violence. The folks who plant the bomb are doing what Randall Flagg told them to, but Mother Abigail, Flagg's opposite number, says again and again that all things serve God. If this is true, and within the context of The Stand it certainly is, then the bomb is actually a stern message from the guy upstairs, a way of saying, "I didn't bring you all this way just so you could start up the same old shit." Near the end of the novel, it was the end of the first, shorter version of the story, Fran asks Stuart Redman if there's any hope at all, if people ever learn from their mistakes. Stu replies, "I don't know," and then pauses. In story time, that pause lasts only as long as it takes the reader to flick his or her eye to the last line. In the writer's study, it went on a lot longer. I searched my mind and heart for something else Stu could say, some clarifying statement. I wanted to find it because, at that moment, if at no other, Stu was speaking for me. In the end, however, Stu simply repeats what he has already said. "I don't know." It was the best I could do. Sometimes the book gives you answers, but not always, and I didn't want to leave the readers who had followed me through hundreds of pages with nothing but some empty platitude I didn't believe myself. There is no moral to the stand. No, we'd better learn or we'll probably destroy the whole damn planet next time. But if the theme stands out clearly enough, those discussing it may offer their own morals and conclusions. Nothing wrong with that. Such discussions are one of the great pleasures of the reading life. Although I'd used symbolism, imagery, and literary homage before getting to my novel about the big plague, without Dracula, for instance, I think there is no Salem's Lot. I'm quite sure that I never thought much about theme before getting roadblocked on the stand. I suppose I thought such things were for better minds and bigger thinkers. I'm not sure I would have gotten to it as soon as I did had I not been desperate to save my story. I was astounded at how really useful thematic thinking turned out to be. It wasn't just a vaporous idea that English professors made you write about on midterm essay exams, discuss the thematic concerns of wise blood in 3 well-reasoned paragraphs, 30 points, but another handy gadget to keep in the toolbox, this one something like a magnifying glass. Since my revelation on the road concerning the bomb in the closet, I have never hesitated to ask myself, either before starting the second draft of a book or while stuck for an idea in the first draft, just what it is I'm writing about, why I'm spending the time when I could be playing my guitar or riding my motorcycle, what got my nose down to the grindstone in the first place and then kept it there. The answer doesn't always come right away, but there usually is one, and it's usually not too hard to find, either. I don't believe any novelist, even one who's written 40-plus books, has too many thematic concerns. I have many interests, but only a few that are deep enough to power novels. These deep interests, I won't quite call them obsessions, include how difficult it is, perhaps impossible, to close Pandora's techno box once it's open. The Stand, the Tommyknockers, Firestarter. The question of why, if there is a God, such terrible things happen. The Stand, desperation, the Green Mile. The thin line between reality and fantasy. The Dark Half, Bag of Bones, the Drawing of the Three. And most of all, the terrible attraction violence sometimes has for fundamentally good people. The Shining, the Dark Half. I've also written again and again about the fundamental differences between children and adults and about the healing power of the human imagination. And I repeat, no big deal. These are just interests which have grown out of my life and thought, out of my experiences as a boy and a man, out of my roles as a husband, a father, a writer, and a lover. They are questions that occupy my mind when I turn out the lights for the night and I'm alone with myself, looking up into the darkness with one hand tucked beneath the pillow. You undoubtedly have your own thoughts, interests, and concerns, and they have arisen, as mine have, from your experiences and adventures as a human being. Some are likely similar to those I've mentioned above, and some are likely very different, but you have them, and you should use them in your work. That's not all those ideas are there for, perhaps, but surely it's one of the things they are good for. I should close this little sermonette with a word of warning. Starting with the questions and thematic concerns is a recipe for bad fiction. Good fiction always begins with story and progresses to theme. It almost never begins with theme and progresses to story. The only possible exceptions to this rule that I can think of are allegories like George Orwell's Animal Farm, and I have a sneaking suspicion that with Animal Farm, the story idea may indeed have come first. If I see Orwell in the afterlife, I mean to ask him. But once your basic story is on paper, you need to think about what it means and enrich your following drafts with your conclusions. To do less is to rob your work and, eventually, your readers of the vision that makes each tale you write uniquely your own. So far, so good. Now let's talk about revising the work. How much and how many drafts? For me, the answer has always been 2 drafts and a polish. With the advent of word processing technology, my polishes have become closer to a 3rd draft. You should realize that I'm only talking about my own personal mode of writing here. In actual practice, rewriting varies greatly from writer to writer. Kurt Vonnegut, for example, rewrote each page of his novels until he got them exactly the way he wanted them. The result was days when he might only manage a page or two of finished copy, and the wastebasket would be full of crumpled, rejected page 71s and 72s. But when the manuscript was finished, the book was finished, by gum. You could set it in type. Yet I think certain things hold true for most writers, and those are the ones I want to talk about now. If you've been writing a while, you won't need me to help you much with this part. You'll have your own established routine. If you're a beginner, though, let me urge that you take your story through at least two drafts, the one you do with the study door closed and the one you do with it open. With the door shut, downloading what's in my head directly to the page, I write as fast as I can and still remain comfortable. Writing fiction, especially a long work of fiction, can be a difficult, lonely job. It's like crossing the Atlantic Ocean in a bathtub. There's plenty of opportunity for self-doubt. If I write rapidly, putting down my story exactly as it comes into my mind, only looking back to check the names of my characters and the relevant parts of their backstories, I find that I can keep up with my original enthusiasm and at the same time outrun the self-doubt that's always waiting to settle in. This first draft, the all-story draft, should be written with no help or interference from anyone else. There may come a point when you want to show what you're doing to a close friend. Very often the close friend you think of first is the one who shares your bed, either because you're proud of what you're doing or because you're doubtful about it. My best advice is to resist this impulse. Keep the pressure on. Don't lower it by exposing what you've written to the doubt, the praise, or even the well-meaning questions of someone from the outside world. Let your hope of success and your fear of failure carry you on, difficult as that may be. There'll be time to show off what you've done when you finish, but even after finishing, I think you must be cautious and give yourself a chance to think while the story is still like a field of freshly fallen snow, absent of any tracks save your own. The great thing about writing with the door shut is that you find yourself forced to concentrate on story to the exclusion of practically everything else. No one can ask you, "What were you trying to express with Garfield's dying words?" Or, "What's the significance of the green dress?" You may not have been trying to express anything with Garfield's dying words, and Maura could be wearing green only because that's what you saw when she came into sight in your mind's eye. On the other hand, perhaps those things do mean something, or will, when you get a chance to look at the forest instead of the trees. Either way, the first draft is the wrong place to think about it. Here's something else. If no one says to you, "Oh, Sam," or "Amy, this is wonderful," you are a lot less apt to slack off or to start concentrating on the wrong thing. Being wonderful, for instance, instead of telling the goddamn story.